Hello, I'm Anila Chan. You are tuned into Modus Operandi. In light of the unfolding tragedies in Israel and Gaza, the U.S. has shifted its attention away from Ukraine. But America isn't the only one. Ukraine's own neighbors, just months ago, pledging unwavering support, now souring on Kyiv as fresh elections prove the prolonged war in Europe isn't as popular as it was sold. All right, let's get into the MO. From former Soviet bloc states to the farthest reaching west of France, little by little, European support for a continued war effort in Ukraine appears to be waning. Led by growing right-leaning sentiments among voters dissatisfied with their economic situation at home, are now forcing political elites to reconsider sending taxpayer-funded military aid to Ukraine. Joining us to dig into this shift across Europe is George Samueli. He is a writer and senior fellow at the Global Policy Institute in London. He's the author of the book Bombs for Peace, NATO's Humanitarian War on Yugoslavia. He also has a daily podcast with Peter Lavelle called The Gaggle. You can find them on locals.com. So first, George, before we get into the former Soviet bloc countries, I got to address the 800-pound gorilla in the room that is the U.S., who has been the biggest financial and military backer of Ukraine. That gorilla appears to have shifted its gaze away from Ukraine over now to Israel after the Hamas attack on civilians in Israel proper. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby had this to say about further funding.
In the near term, we've got appropriations and authorities for both Ukraine and for Israel. But you don't want to be trying to bake in long-term support when you're at the end of the rope. And in Ukraine, on the Ukraine funding, we're coming near to the end of the rope. I mean, today we announced $200 million, and we'll keep that aid going as long as we can, but it's not gonna be indefinite. So are we moving with a sense of alacrity? Absolutely. I couldn't give you a date certain on the calendar.
So what do you make of that comment, George? Has the U.S. abandoned Kyiv?
I really don't think so. I think he's referring to the impasse that has been achieved in the House of Representatives. There is a lot of opposition among Republican congressmen to any more assistance to Ukraine. And so basically the Biden administration is at the moment having real difficulties moving any kind of appropriation for Ukraine. That on top of the preoccupation with the Middle East obviously has put Ukraine on the back burner. However, there's a majority in both the House and the Senate to go on funding Ukraine. There's not a majority among the Republican conference, but overall, since the Democrats are unanimous behind Ukraine, and the Republican senators are, by and large, with the odd exception like Rand Paul or J.D. Vance, they're, again, in favor of sending more money to Ukraine. So I think they are going to come up with the money. I mean, the numbers are there, the support is there. But at the moment, there is this impasse. There isn't a House Speaker. And nobody really knows what's going to happen in the Middle East. I mean, who knows, this could explode. American involvement could escalate. But my feeling is that Ukraine is such a good gig for so many wealthy, well-connected individuals in the United States. You know, obviously the arms contractors, the military-industrial complex, the think tanks that are funded by the military-industrial complex, the financiers who are being bankrolled by the U.S. government, ostensibly that they're going to be rebuilding Ukraine. There's a lot of monetary, financial interest tied up with Ukraine. I don't think they're just going to let it go and say, oh, well, forget it, let's go on to something else. So I think for the time being, yeah, I think that there's no money for Ukraine, but I think, you know, within a few weeks, there will be money.
Slovakia recently held parliamentary elections that found the former PM, Robert Fico's populist left party, the Smer SSD, winning and forming a coalition government rather quickly. Their platform pledged to halt all military aid to Ukraine, but they deny being pro-Russian. Meanwhile, Fico has been known to refer to the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov as a dear friend. Are these mixed signals coming from Bratislava, or do you think this accurately reflects the sentiments of the Slovakian citizens?
I think it does reflect the Slovakian citizens. I think what that election showed that in Slovakia and in many European countries, standard of living is going down, inflation is on the rise. There is a continuing surge of migrants, with governments not really able to cope with this flow of migrants. And people are really getting tired of this war, because the war is impoverishing Europeans. And ultimately, the Slovakians, like the Hungarians, are asking, well, what are we getting out of this? So leave aside the question of the danger of the escalation, the danger of getting involved in a serious shooting war with Russia. Voters are just wondering, what exactly are we getting out of this war? And I think Fico clearly, you know, spoke to this concern, much as Viktor Orban did, but Orban did that from the beginning. And I think that the politicians, the leading politicians of Europe, like, you know, Macron or Chancellor Scholz, and of course, you know, the head queen, Ursula von der Leyen, they're preoccupied with Ukraine, but they've not been able to explain in any way to the peoples of Europe what's in it for them. Why exactly is this great commitment being made for Ukraine? What are the stakes here? Why is it that the Europeans need to be fighting this war against Russia in Russia's backyard? You know, how is anyone in Europe benefiting from it? So that's why Fico says that we're not particularly well disposed towards Russia, or we're not particular friends with Russia. That's why all this, the media, which spin it as, oh, he's pro-Russian. They say the same thing about Orban. It's pro-Russian, which is complete nonsense. Neither Fico nor Orban is pro-Russian. They represent their people, and they just simply say this war makes very little sense, and particularly if we are steadily becoming poorer and poorer. Our standard of living is going down, and there's another winter coming up. Could be a colder winter. Last winter was mild. This could be a quite cold winter. Where's the fuel going to come from? You know, already this is triggering inflation in our countries. It's getting harder and harder to justify this Ukraine caper, and I think that explains Fico's victory.
Now, speaking of the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, he has, as some might describe it, gone against the NATO grain in the way of Ukraine support. I mean, not to mention within his own borders, promoting a very socially conservative, you know, Christian values type of rhetoric, especially after USAID boss Samantha Power made an unannounced visit to the country. Orban has been strongly against the promotion of alternative lifestyles, if you will. So this doesn't really align with U.S. agendas for democracies. He's been criticized for not being strong enough against Vladimir Putin as well. Despite being an EU and NATO member state, Orban doesn't appear to be on the same boat as the others. Does this, in effect, put Hungary back within the Russian sphere of influence?
No, it really doesn't. Hungary's position is that, you know, while in a kind of pro forma way, it supports EU policy toward Russia on Ukraine. So sanctions, by and large, you know, Hungary supports the sanctions policy, obviously condemning Russia and so on. At the same time, Hungary is saying, well, no, we're going to have cutouts for ourselves. You know, we need oil, we need gas, we need Russian cooperation on the nuclear power, and we're going to go on signing agreements with Russia. You know, this just signed another agreement just the other day. So that's, you know, the position of Orban and Szijjártó, his foreign minister, is that we will do whatever we need to do in favor of Hungarian national interest. That's our job. You know, we were elected to work on behalf of Hungary, and we're going to do it. And now where we can agree with the EU, we'll agree with the EU, but always our eyes are on what's in Hungary's interest. Now, that is combined with Orban's position, which is that this war makes no sense for the obvious reason. He said this many times, Ukraine cannot win this war. Russia will not lose this war. There's no way that Russia will just simply accept defeat. Therefore, what is the logical step that Europe needs to take, which it is to bring this war to an end, to essentially demand an immediate ceasefire, immediate armistice, and that's it. And Europe is too weak to do anything like that. The United States calls the shots. So Orban's view is now that nothing much is going to happen until there's a change of government in the United States. And Orban is explicit about this, Donald Trump returns to power, because then he says basically when Trump returns, peace will be possible in Ukraine. And to him, peace is just simply immediately, just, you know, ceasefire. You know, don't do anything, just you know, bring it to an end. So he's obviously bucking the trend within NATO. But NATO's problem with Orban, much as they find him utterly detestable, is that they don't know what to do with him. They can't very well just kick him out, because Hungary is a vital piece of real estate. I mean, it's right there in Central Europe. You can't just simply lose Hungary and keep NATO going. So he knows that he can make all these statements. He can anger the EU, NATO, and you talk about Samantha Power. Samantha Power obviously just absolutely loathes the sort of Fidesz philosophy, as you said, the social conservatism. He's essentially, and I don't know whether you call it anti-Americanism, but certainly anti-democratic partyism. I mean, I think that he hates the America of the current Democratic Party. They would like to get him out. So they thought they had a shot in the election last year. He won by a landslide. So I think they realize now Orban has won four landslides in Hungary. There's no one really to challenge him. He's still a young man. So they know they're going to have to live with Orban for some time.
Yeah, Orban isn't going anywhere. I mean, much in the same way that Turkey's Erdogan isn't moving either. So the political class just has to figure out how to work with them. All right, coming up next, Europe's swing to the right, from Italy's Giorgia Meloni to Germany's rising AfD party. We'll discuss it when we return with George Samueli. Sit tight, the MO will be right back.
переживаю за военных, которые погибают, но они достойны защищать нашу родину.
По нам начали стрелять украинские. Мне ногу ранили. Вот так вот аж. Да чуть-чуть остался шрам.
Фашисты первые наступали на нашу землю. А мы защищали ее, терпели, погибали. Но они все равно идут до победы.
Welcome back to the MO. I'm Manila Chan. All across Europe, to the dismay of the U.S., recent elections at the local level there are proving the populist right victorious. Is that an indicator that Europeans are increasingly growing tired of American lectures on going woke? George Samueli, thank you so much for sticking around with us. So let's talk more about this shift to the right. It's not a trend happening only in Eastern European or Central European states. I mean, if we look at Austria, a similar shift in sentiment there. Germany's AfD party gaining a lot of momentum. And of course, in France, America's oldest ally, Marine Le Pen, after losing a couple national elections, you know, instead of fading off into obscurity like the others, she's actually gaining in popularity. How do you read this move toward the populist right? And what's that mean for Ukraine? And is this a rejection of something, George? I mean, what is that something?
Well, that's a very good question. I think it is a rejection of globalism. It is a rejection of liberalism, but liberalism in terms of its social values, liberalism in its sort of vacuous notion that there are no nations, there are no peoples, and you know, there's just, you know, there's a place you sit anywhere and then you just plug in and on the internet and it doesn't matter who you are and where you are. The notion that there's a sort of a rich, comfortable elite that is constantly getting wealthy. You know, there's crisis after crisis, people are becoming impoverished, but this elite is continually getting wealthier and wealthier and arrogating more and more power to itself. So, you know, everyone saw what happened during COVID when, again, you know, the wealthy got even wealthier, much, much wealthier, and power oozed to governments as they manufactured a crisis, generated hysteria, and essentially, you know, turned Europe into a kind of a version of China, a communist China. You know, everyone, lot of people being locked into their homes. I mean, it was clearly a deliberate project.
The German foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock of the Greens, she has been an ardent and vocal supporter of Ukraine, staunchly anti-Russian. Many say she's even overrun the actual chancellor, Olaf Scholz, and his SPD party, the same party of Angela Merkel. But recent local elections in Germany have found all other major parties on their back foot with the rise of AfD. AfD is polling nationally between 19 and 23%, well above any of the other parties, the SPD, the FDP, and certainly the Greens. They currently make up the existing coalition government there. This could really shake the balance of power in Germany in the next general elections. Your thoughts on this? I mean, Germany, on the national level.
Well, that's very interesting because all of the political parties, all of the respectable establishment parties, that's the Christian Democrats, the Social Democrats, the Greens, the FDP, they've all said, no, absolutely not. We will never cooperate with the AfD. No cooperation. Irrespective of how well they do, we simply will not cooperate. Well, if you go down that path, then that just simply the AfD will continue to grow in strength. And then you have people will become more and more resentful that you're just essentially blocking out from power a very sizable movement. I mean, the idea, you know, let's say 23%, let's say it goes up to 25%. So it's actually 25% of the German electorate will just be ignored. We're just not going to pay any attention to their desires. That's not a recipe for a successful statecraft. And in particular, given German economic decline, I mean, Germany is, in recession. The basis of German economic strength, the Wirtschaftswunder, was a cheap source of energy. They were getting this cheap energy from Russia. That worked so well for Germany. Now they're not getting any of that. The Nord Stream, that isn't flowing anymore. And then Scholz was humiliated by the destruction of this gas pipeline. So either your great ally, the United States, blew it up, which doesn't say much for you if the Americans can just blow up your own source of energy, or, as the Americans and the German governments claim, it was the Ukrainians who did it. Well, that doesn't say much for your great ally, Ukraine. Either way, you look ridiculous, stupid, and your economy is tanking. This is what Germany is famous for, its great export industries, all its cars, its pharmaceuticals, its chemicals, its consumer products. I mean, the German goods are renowned throughout the world for their quality. If that's gone, well, what else does Germany have? And so I think that to insist in those circumstances, well, we're just going to continue to hold on to power, establishment parties, and we're going to keep out the interloper, the AfD. That's not a recipe for success. I mean, you can keep somebody out if you're doing a good job, if at least, the German economy is thriving. But if German economy is tanking, and the Germans are like these Bavarians, are going to think, hey, well, what's happened to our successful, prosperous lifestyle? I mean, it's disappearing. They're not going to take kindly to that. So I think that program of just simply blocking AfD from power, I think it's doomed to failure. And that doesn't mean that they're not going to go down that path, but it's one that's going to lead eventually to a very serious political crisis in Germany.
Now let's head down to Romania. President Zelensky was actually denied the opportunity to speak before that country's parliament. He got the same rejection treatment by Kevin McCarthy some months ago when he asked to speak before the U.S. Congress. Now, up until this point, Romania has been happy to follow along the anti-Russia, pro-Ukraine sentiment. But is Romania also souring on Ukraine? Because if Poland and Romania sour on Ukraine, that's really bad news for Kyiv. Their countries share the largest borders with Ukraine. And worth mentioning, the historical and territorial claims to current-day Ukrainian territory. What do you make of all of that?
Yeah, no question. Romania, like Hungary, and like Poland, of course, lost territory after World War II to Ukraine. I mean, it was basically, Hungary, Romania, and Poland had territory sliced off and added to what was then the Soviet Union, but then basically was inherited by Ukraine. And of course, there are Romanians living in Ukraine. But again, I think it is a case of the public in Romania, as in Slovakia, as in Hungary, is souring. They don't see any real conclusion to this war, and it's getting tiresome. The whole Zelensky shtick with his wearing those ridiculous fatigues. I mean, the guy is not a military person. Why is he wearing these military fatigues? Arriving, but essentially it's a kind of a begging bowl. I mean, I want give me more. I need more. I think Romania is souring. So Romania is quite concerned about getting sucked into this war. Again, it's in the neighborhood, just like Slovakia is right in the neighborhood. So if this war continues to escalate, you could get sucked in. You could be in the line of fire. And I think that's they really are not happy with it. I mean, when you think about Eastern Europe, there are clearly those East Europeans who are absolutely demented. I mean, the Baltic states, you know, every day they wake up and think, you know, how can I antagonize the Russians even more today? What can I do? You know, what statues can I take down? You know, what Red Army cemeteries can I desecrate? You know, just to annoy the Russians all the more. So you know that's the way they operate, and then they say, "Oh, we're really afraid of Russia." You know, so you know we're so afraid that we're going out of our way to antagonize them at every moment of the day. So you have those states, but you also have you know like Romania, like Hungary and Slovakia, that don't see it that way. They don't really see their interest tied up with continually antagonizing Russia. I mean, again, they may not like Russia very much. I mean, none of them like them very much, but they don't see any reason to be continually antagonizing them. And so that's why I think that Zelensky hasn't realized that there's a moment in which, you know, he has outstayed his welcome. And I think that's what happened in Romania.
George Samueli, thank you for that. Always a fun chat. George is a writer and senior fellow at the Global Policy Institute in London, author of the book called Bombs for Peace, NATO's Humanitarian War on Yugoslavia. And make sure you check out his daily podcast with Peter Lavelle called The Gaggle. Find them on locals.com. All right, that is going to do it for this episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy and current affairs. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you again next time to figure out the MO.